Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Life is full of what ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Benjamin Richardson.
Hello.
And Josh Brown.
Hello.
And we're going to talk all things indie games. Now, we've been talking about this in the office for a while because indie games are just blooming lovely, aren't they,
pretty
to be honest?
Decent, aren't they?
They're pretty good.
The best, I think.
They are kind of the best.
I generally agree.
So I thought we would initially just start out with what sort of stuff we're playing at the minute, because you were on Yoko's Island Express.
Yes. Yoko's Island Express is the last indie game I finished. Mm-hmm. If anyone hasn't played it, first of all, do play it.
As you say, we're all rushing to...
do my best to explain it. The best way to put it is a cross between Sonic Spinball and Ori and the Blind Forest.
Good.
And if that doesn't automatically sound unbelievable, what's wrong with you? I mean, it's the synopsis of the story is that you play as a little ant.
It's lovely that
arrived on an island, as in the tale, and he's been designated as the new postmaster, and basically he has to deliver letters. But he has to do it... as a pinball, effectively.
You wonder why the indie game scene hasn't caught on, to be honest. Yeah. Go on.
Triple A games, you're like, you're a space marine, you're going to save the world. Indie game, you're an ant.
And delivering letters.
As a pinball.
Yeah.
Is that, we can all relate with that. Well, it's actually he pushes a ball of letters around with him.
Right.
Like a dung beetle.
Brilliant.
But it's not good. Dung, it's mail.
That's the quote that you want for the back of the box.
Some people do deliver that.
It's not dung, it's mail. Yeah. But fair. Josh, it'd be good to say, do you have any indie games you're currently playing through?
Not currently, because I've been playing Resident Evil 1 Remake, and then Resident Evil 1, and then all the other Resident Evil games. Before then, though,
why?
It was mostly, because I just like Resident Evil. I'm in the mood, right?
Weird.
I'm ignoring all these games, but before then it was Celeste, and then a little game called Undertale, which I finally got around to playing.
Since Josh hasn't been playing indie games recently, I'll add a couple more.
You
mentioned Undertale, I've been playing a game called Zero Ranger.
Okay.
Which is a shoot 'em up, but it's very much the Undertale of the bullet hell genre.
Okay.
It's extremely tongue in cheek, it's self referential, it references a lot of historical games and not just shoot 'em ups either.
Mm-hmm.
It looks divine, it's all pixel art. I thoroughly recommend anyone give it a go.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds delicious.
I'm gonna walk back a little thing because I should have outlined at the beginning that
it's about oranges.
I love oranges, but the reason that we're talking about indies at this point in time is mainly because you look at the complete flaming tire fire that is something like Anthem, or the general sort of approach to games as a service, the way that they're sort of being talked about at the minute in the industry, and something that's been, we've talked about for so long, and anyone who sort of plays a lot of games knows that the most innovative ideas or, you know, things that point to the future of the industry are inherently in indie games. They're inherently in something where, you know, risks can be taken, or, you know, there's more artistic flourish, more creativity, or whatever. So it's kind of just, we're going to pick it apart. But it's just that idea that, you know, the reason that you love video games, that reason is more inherent to the indie market than something that's in the AAA space, for the most part. Because I still love God of War, Spidey, Red Dead, whatever, but I also love Hotline Miami and Downwell and Celeste and all those sorts of things. So I guess it's kind of passing out a lot of the stigma around indie gaming, because I think a lot of people still think that it's all pixel platforming. Do you guys find that there is still a lean into those kind of genres, or over time it's changed?
The stigmata on the hands of indie gaming has gradually began to fade.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of people who have become extremely fatigued with the regular AAA offerings all being the same, the price of them in particular as well, and the expectations of them. The fact that you don't have enough time to play every game. I think last month was 4 came out around about the same time.
Day, to be honest. Yeah.
So, and for a population, people who got into gaming 10 years ago, you know, they're not getting younger, and your responsibilities grow. So I can understand entirely why they'd be drawn to indie gaming.
Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of like mechanics as well, like, you know, you can sort of, you can like something like, I can't think of, there's a name of a game which escapes me, but it's, it plays like Doom and it's, I think it's called like Devil's Cross or something. And you're, it, you know, it's very much focused on that arena style combat thing where you're taking out a whole bunch of enemies. Or something like Downwell is like a platformer, quote unquote, but you play down the screen. Yeah. You're sort of like jumping down as you're shooting stuff. And like a lot of those things, you know, the reason that you love games, like, yes, you can tie on a great story or a great set of characters or whatever, but you need those immaculate mechanics. And I think that a lot of indie games focus primarily on the gameplay more than the blockbuster sort of feel. Here's this, you know, great campaign or whatever.
I think that's why there's kind of like a certain stigma around it, because as a young rapscallion during my uni days and my college days when I had no disposable income, it was never sort of viable for me to purchase one of these smaller experiences that is much cheaper than the average AAA title. Mm-hmm. But when you buy into a AAA title, you have like an expectation of, like you were saying,
was a question of value.
Yes, it's a question of value. When I, at least for me, when I was younger, I was thinking, well, I could drop 15, 20 quid on this sort of smaller experience and probably have a great time, but, you know, I'm going to be done with it in a few hours' time. So I think that's kind of like the antithesis of what you were saying there, Ben. Like, now, when I don't have all the time in the world, I don't want these 50-hour, like, Anthem-esque titles that I have to live on, and I want the other experiences, but I can sort of see why you might be averse to that if you're kind of like on the flip side.
I think one of the reasons that the length thing is such a big deal is that, like, obviously they can monetize it, games as a service and all that kind of stuff. But that goes hand in hand with developer budgets and the idea that, you know, they need recurrent spending methods to recoup these like ridiculous, you know, stratospherically high development costs. Whereas on the indie side, it's balanced a hell of a lot better, or at least the assumption is that they know what they're doing a little bit. Well, no, they know what they're doing a bit more, but they balance those things a bit better. They have more attainable goals, let's say.
The scope is a lot smaller. Yeah. And as you said, development teams tend to be a lot smaller. It's, indie games aren't cheap to produce by any stretch of imagination, but it's a lot easier to plan when a game's content isn't going to get out of hand and when it doesn't need to be infinite. You can know in advance at the very start what we need to do, how long it'll take, and you can set a proper a roadmap, as we use.
Yes,
as we say now.
Well, now that the whole roadmap thing is like, even launch is kind of like your early access starting point now in the AAA space, or at least it is if you take Anthem as an example. You know, and you're going to be plugging content into that going forward. I don't think that's that been received that well. I don't think no one was asking for that.
No, I completely agree. You know, people aren't asking for it, but they are being given it.
Yeah,
which is another reason why they might gradually migrate to indies.
Well, I mean, I just think that, like, you know, the reason that we talk about games, the thing that you got into it, there's all that sort of skill level, there's the arcade mentality, there's the whole like prove yourself, prove your gamer worth and all that kind of stuff, and that's kind of waxed and waned as like stories have come in and become more of the focus. But like I said, like, you know, if I'm going to pick something up and have a couple of games on something, it tends to be more indie focused. A lot of the story based stuff I'll get through it and it's pretty much done, whereas like something like Hotline I'm going back to all the time, or like Rocket League or whatever.
That's a fascinating take, because I'm like kind of on the other side of that. I love like the mechanical focus of indie games, but some of the most resonant stories that I've played through, like last year was Celeste and stuff.
Yes.
I think indie games have the space to deliver kind of like a really sort of emotionally driven story that can like take risks or deliver it in at least a way that the AAA space doesn't. Like, they can use the form of actual video games to tell a story in a unique way, and that's kind of, that's been the big appeal to me for indie games. Like, I love Hotline Miami, of course, but to me that doesn't have the same sort of staying power as something like, and I might get a lot of crap for this, but like Gone Home or
Definitely.
You know, games like that.
I was going to talk about that because I had a note down here of like, remember the whole the resurgence of the conversation around whether video games are art? That sort of came to like its zenith in like 2011 through like 2013, because games got inducted into the Smithsonian Museum, I think it was. And so the conversation kind of came up, and that was when Roger Ebert did his whole piece on games can never be art because the experience is authored by the player, therefore you take it away from the creator. Completely missed the point, because games are coded, therefore it's authorship on behalf of the developer. Whatever, wrote 20,000 words for it for my dissertation. And so I think like that whole conversation, though, that kind of advanced the medium in a way that brought up smaller experiences like Limbo or Braid, or there was even like Super Meat Boy. There was that sort of elevation of like smaller titles to say like, oh, well, they're more arty, they're more sort of art focused.
Yeah.
Whereas the bigger games went down the more pronouncedly like, you know, easy access route in terms of stories and stuff. But I do think coming out of that the indie space is where more risky storytelling gets done. Gone Home is a perfect example.
It's a parallel to the dichotomy in cinema between mainstream cinema, blockbusters, and art house cinema, where directors are prepared to take risks because they have ambition beyond profits.
Yeah.
Which is definitely a thing that happens in the indie scene.
Well, that's, I mentioned that in the reason that corporate gaming is a poison is that, you know, the people at the top of the piles, especially in the third-party space, where they don't have to worry about console life cycles and respectable libraries over time, they can cash in and get out. And I think that you're seeing that. I said that in that video, that I think they're in the industry for the wrong reasons.
Well, we're talking about investors and publishers.
Yes, and shareholders.
The actual people charged with actually developing
the... No, that's my point. I'm only talking about the people at the very top making the number crunching decisions, not the artistic talent on the bottom. Which, if you go down the indie scene, you can invert that. You know, like something like Dead Cells has like a more like socialistic approach to the way that they even share their funds on the development side, the way that they pay their wages and stuff. Like all that is completely inverted on the indie scene.
That's what's kind of blown my mind recently. I don't even know why I didn't think of it before, but there was a great a few months ago before all the Destiny stuff and all the Activision stuff, there was a great piece by Jason Schreier on Kotaku who like kind of sort of went into those business decisions and like the approach behind them. And it was that you at least I assumed before then that the more successful a game was or a franchise was or a studio was, the more freedom they'd get to sort of you know, flex their muscles and sort of do what they want because they're bringing in all this money. But then, like, no, that just funnels them even more down to a specific route because a bar has been set. They need to keep that level of success going, which means more focus testing, which means more sort of like priming into as many people as possible.
Even then, though, I mean, you know, you have like Naughty Dog or Rockstar or CD Projekt Red. Like, they still prioritize the we're gonna do whatever we want kind of thing. And Naughty Dog seem to have that sway with Sony where they're just sort of like, we want to do like The Last of Us, we want to do something different. Onto a new IP, and like Rockstar do as well.
Well, I'd say with the big difference with Naughty Dog and their relationship with Sony is that Sony's primary focus is selling consoles,
yes,
not software. Mm-hmm. So they're prepared to have a studio create unique titles, exclusive titles that they can sell a console on the basis of, and then even if it is a loss leader, that's fine. That's sort of the point.
Well, that was something that, like, Sony kind of brought back like a lot this generation, and it wasn't Shuhei Yoshida, I forget the name of the dude, that was speaking about the future of PlayStation and just said, look, they're completely invested in making, didn't exactly say single player experiences, but it was something about invested in continuing worthwhile experiences that we've seen this generation. And you know, and that points to stuff like Spider-Man or like Days Gone, these like Ghost of Tsushima games that are entirely, or at least marketed as single player experiences. I don't think there are any multiplayer modes in them. And so it's like, they're one of the only first-party, you know, companies with these million-dollar budgets or whatever. Well, not millions, but a lot. Getting put into single-player stories, whereas the other companies aren't necessarily doing as much.
Nintendo's the other
Yeah. Like you said, they're also like platform holders
again,
and they're
Nintendo,
trying to sell.
The hardware manufacturer. It's the model that they've been used to since the early days of Famicom. Mm-hmm. Is that the whole point? Is that you create software to sell the hardware? Mm-hmm. Which, that's not something a company like EA has to be concerned about whatsoever.
True. I want to ask you a really weird question based out of the fact that, because you have all these like clashing mentalities in terms of, you know, storytelling focus or gameplay focus or character focus or levels and genres and all that kind of stuff. Why do you guys play games? Like, I know it's meant to be vague as hell, but like, it's that thing. It's like, what are you really taking away from it? Because like, one of the statistics that came out the last few years is that like 90% of people don't finish games, and like that assumes that they don't see full stories. But so the takeaway would be, well, they enjoyed the mechanics as they were, and people sink hundreds of hours into Destiny's online mode, so they want, you know, they want bankable mechanics. And I think that's the mentality that's been taken and ran with on the third party side. But what do you guys think in terms of, like, is it a bit of everything?
Oddly enough, I was thinking about this the other night, I was thinking about the difference between movies and games, and I put so
as
much
we do
time,
being
as we
massive
do.
Nerds
exactly
yeah.
I put a, I was thinking about this in the shower of all so I was thinking about
sitting
all,
down with yeah.
of all the time I put into video games, and I was sort of had a bit of an existential crisis and was like, why? You know what I mean? Why am I so invested in it? Just pulling my interests apart.
Bioshock.
And I think, obviously, I'm here for everything. I'm here for the stories. My favorite games of all time are story-driven, and yet I think the amount of hours I put into games are mostly based on sort of gameplay loops. Like, I've been playing through Resident Evil 1 and Resident Evil 1 Remake, like I said, at the weekend.
Insane.
And that's not necessarily because of the story, it's because that game has such a great loop of item management and sort of assessing your resources and trying to make it from one end of the mansion to the other with as few things in your inventory as possible so you can get the quest items and then avoiding enemies and thinking about where they are in relation to you. And like, that is such a stimulating sort of experience for me, and that's, I think that's kind of where I'm at. Like, I didn't even realize until this weekend that I was so mechanically focused. But I suppose that's the same itch kind of indie games sort of scratch. Like, I think indie games love their form and they love being video games, whereas when you go into the AAA space or something, it is, or at least there was, maybe we're moving away from it now, but there was a distinction between storytelling and gameplay. They were very separate kind of elements that didn't necessarily inform each other. Like, it didn't really matter how you played the game. The story would still be told the same. And that brings up a lot of conversation about
dissonance and stuff. Well, it goes into all the marketing stuff, too. Like, you know, they want to rival Hollywood. They want to have their big over-the-top video game trailers. Like, you never see a big over-the-top indie game trailer. Or at least if you do, I can't think of one off the top of my head.
Well, the marketing budget tends to be a fraction of
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, they know...
They usually know that the best way for their games to sell is word of mouth. Mm-hmm. And Groundswell... Yeah. Like a groundswell of support. It's a completely different audience to act in, so I don't really need it.
Well, yeah, and it's like, yeah, and then because of that, you know, it's literally, it's the same reason, and again, it goes into the growing up playing games where you just go, oh man, have you played this thing? I recommend this level. God, you got to see this thing. It plays like X, Y, Z. Like, you know, there's more innovation on the base mechanical side, on the indie side, and they know that it'll be recommendable, you know, in smaller circles, but it's more worthwhile.
When you ask the questionnaire about why we play games, and I was thinking about this in the bath.
Stood up in the bath and I was sat down
Stood
in the shower.
Brilliant. Thinking, yeah. I thought about
I'm
it in
not,
the car.
I'm doing this right, but anyway, as I was trying to wrap my head around that, I was thinking, when did I start playing games? Mm-hmm. And I must have been—it was very, very young age. I must have been about 3 or 4 years old, playing on a Commodore 64,
right?
Because I'm ancient.
And I was playing a game. 110.
I think my favorite game was one called Split Personality, where it was effectively portraits of political figures at the time, like Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. I don't know if any
hip
people.
Hop.
This is so Bendis.
This is the most Benjamin thing ever. But yeah,
and there were like tiles that you had to arrange interfaces, and
you were a kid.
I was a kid.
Brilliant.
Yeah. There was no real political content that I could tell. I mean, there might have been, but it was. It went over my head anyway. And I guess playing games is just something I did from that point.
Right.
Because it's a toy when you're 3 years old. You don't think about it any deeper than that.
Sure.
But as time goes on, it's already become part of who you are. You play games, you look forward to the next game. Mm-hmm. You're following the industry as you're growing up. You're seeing where it's going. So you're automatically interested without necessarily being an actual, like, as you know, you had a proper reason why. But for me, it was just, that's just what I do.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what I was always looking forward to what the next innovation would be, or the next new genre would be, or the next great mechanic. And I think over the past 5 or 6 years, that's vanished from the AAA scene for me, where now I feel like every AAA game
plays the same.
Has to play the same, almost. Like, you mentioned how much indie games revel in their own mechanical.
I think they can afford to try more stuff, yeah.
I always find it's very unusual if you pick up a AAA game now, how there's almost like a standard control scheme.
Yes.
A standard way of it handling, and any deviations is considered a flaw.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I really enjoy about independent games, is to play something that feels different and unique.
Well, even, I mean, something like Brothers, like, I mean, I know it was published by EA, but the mentality behind it is definitely indie. Yeah. But, like, the way you play that, it's like one controller per analog stick.
And it's
nothing else plays like that.
It's quite sort of difficult at first to get used to it, but once you do, you really enjoy it, and you come away thinking, I've not played anything like that.
Yeah.
Which I think is really, really important. And also, I might mention on Brothers, one of the few games that has brought me to tears. I don't have many emotions, but that's despite not a single word of dialogue being spoken throughout it. And and that's really massively helped by the fact that it's only 6 hours long.
Yes.
You know, it doesn't outstay its welcome. It tells the story it wants to, and it gets in and gets out.
Mm-hmm. You said something there, Ben, about you just played games because that's what you did. I was sort of at that point again back in uni, early college, where I was just going through the same existential crisis, and I was like, I just play games. I enjoy them. I was still in the shower because I never left. I don't look like I actually get a shower, but I promise you I actually do. Yeah, so I was thinking, I just play games because I just play games. I don't know why. I don't really know what I get from it. And that's when I started like watching YouTube sort of like breakdowns and critical analysis of it. And it was actually Super Bunny Hop. That was the first critical analysis channel that I jumped into. And I was like, oh my God, games can be viewed as this, like, as like a proper art form.
Yep.
And it has like the mechanics mean something. They can they act as a conduit for themes and messaging and
stories.
Form of storytelling. And that sort of opened me up. But now I think we're at a point in the AAA space, like you said, because everything sort of, even if it's not the exact same, you have like the basic control scheme. Even that sort of is a homogeneity, I think I said that right.
Yes.
There, that sort of pushes back against that sort of like analysis of themes.
On the point you make there, when you discovered that games could be a window to something much greater than just
terrorists, just Pac-Man, just whatever.
That's actually, because I've something older than you, as mentioned them. That's what I was waiting for, that to become a part of gaming.
Mm-hmm.
I was growing up with the industry, and I was really looking forward to games becoming art.
Yeah.
To see them deliver stories that only the gaming medium could deliver. Mm-hmm. You know, something unique, something that movies couldn't do. At the time, games were trying to be movies, and gradually that started to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's fell away again, as you said.
It's, well, I mean, try to be big. I really want to talk about that thing about, like, you know, like the industry used to chase innovation in the AAA space. Like, you know, and I remember the first time I saw the PS2's graphics, like, saw Tekken Tag Tournament, and it was always this graphical focus. And it's like, and we sort of, like, you know, chase control schemes. Like, it was after Call of Duty that everything became homogenized, and every first person shooter has the Call of Duty control scheme, at least in terms of you're aiming with the left trigger and shooting with the right trigger. If something asked you to shoot with X now, you'd feel really weird.
So, yeah,
or zoom in with the right stick or whatever.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Before we go any further, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor, Masterclass. With the amount of time we spend discussing and analyzing video games on this channel, it's always good to understand exactly how these experiences are put together. And fortunately for me, I can do just that with Masterclass. With Masterclass's streaming service, you can learn from the best to become your best, studying and growing with over 200 plus of the world's leading instructors. For me, I've been having a blast using a class on video game design by The Sims creator Will Wright to find out exactly how game mechanics are designed around player psychology, as well as learning how important playtesting is to shipping the titles that you and I both love. But it hasn't stopped there, as I've also been brushing up on my practical filmmaking skills directly from my favourite movie director, Martin Scorsese, as well as trying to get back in the cooking game with Roy Choi's amazing course on intuitive cooking. Seriously, my kitchen is a mess, but my belly has never been more grateful. For just $10 a month, an annual membership with Masterclass gets you unlimited access to courses on your phone, computer, smart TV, or even via audio-only modes. Even better, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and 88% of members feel that the service has made a positive impact on their lives. And to put the cherry on top of that cake, right now, What Culture Gaming listeners get an additional 15% off any annual membership at masterclass.com/gaming. That's 15% off at masterclass.com/gaming. What's that? You want it one more time? Well, that's the URL, masterclass.com/gaming. Right, now I'm going to watch Tony Hawk try to teach me how to ollie properly. I'll see you all soon.
You might recall when The Last Guardian came out. Mm-hmm. I remember we were discussing it at the time, how we both thought the control scheme was peculiar.
Yeah.
You had to jump with a triangle button, I believe.
But I remember, though, like, it sounds like I'm 100. I remember, even in the 2000s, every game had a different control scheme.
That's right.
And well, it was, getting used to a new thing.
I've spoke before about the footprints that the games leave behind, the manual identity. Mm-hmm. So if you play a Resident Evil or Resident Evil 2 on the PlayStation, that has those tank-like controls. But you know you're playing Resident Evil.
Yeah.
Like you could completely change the landscape and keep those controls, and it feels like Resident Evil. Mm-hmm. Likewise, you could substitute that with Tomb Raider, where it's a very specific way of moving. You know, you have to get to the edge of a block and one step back and all that. No other games like that. That's entirely Tomb Raider.
Yeah. Oh, for the first ones, yeah. And especially in terms of the way that you were exploring. And like that, I mean, that's a very specific Tomb Raider point, but I love about the old ones that when you finally climb up some massive chasm thing, because you're fighting the controls, quote unquote, to get there, when you finally make that final leap for the final handhold, you do feel like you've accomplished something. And I think that's something that the new Tomb Raiders have lost. That's a wider conversation. But those like individual control schemes did play into their games. Like Resident Evil's control schemes, you really feel like, oh my God, I'm getting chased by this thing and can I get out? And you're like fumbling and, you know, you're about to get attacked by some some unseen enemy or whatever. And like there was a way, intentionally or otherwise, that those things were connected back then, that they've kind of lost when all the control schemes kind of blur together. But though, like, yeah, that overall thing where like the reason that we play games, or it's part of it, is like in the innovation, is seeing where the industry is going to go. Like, maybe this is where the industry ends up, because it's like watching looking at the graphics for Devil May Cry 5, mm-hmm. absolutely stunning. And I watched Digital Foundry side by side.
Yeah.
And I have it on the PS4 Pro, no point. Get it on the PS4. Doesn't matter. And it looks exactly the same. Apart from literally, because I've reviewed this so much, literally there's one scene, there's 3 seconds where the frame rate drops in the regular version and it doesn't on the Pro. Brilliant. Everything else, it's fine. I was watching this Digital Foundry thing and I was like, why do we even need another console cycle? Like, what are we going to get? What's the PS5 or the Xbox, whatever, going to give us, really?
See, we've kind of butted heads on this before, because yes. I know you're like in this regard, so like more a champion of like mechanics and like yes. how games feel rather than how
innovation.
But for me, it was when I played Uncharted 4, mm-hmm. and like the graphics and that was spectacular. But for me, I was sold on a next gen of sort of prettier graphics and prettier right. visuals because of how emotions were conveyed through characters in that game. And I know you don't necessarily need it. I can cry at a text based game.
Totally.
But when I got to a scene in that where Elena is like, she has like a single tear coming down, I never seen like crying like right. done in such a convincing and authentic way, and I was just kind of blown away by it, because I was, if we're going to go down that route and we're going to go more cinematic, then I like that we're getting closer in parity to sort
that was desperate to find those little moments to justify the fact that you'd have to buy this brand new hardware.
This is where Benji's opinion on AAA games comes in.
not in that case. There have been other cases like Scott's Devil May Cry 5 thing where I've had to really scrutinize the screen and sort of look for differences or knock the black level up or try to fiddle around with settings. But in that one case, it sort of caught me by surprise, because I bought Uncharted 4 just for like the story, because I knew I was going to like it. And then that was like an additive moment where I was convinced.
Mm-hmm. In terms of hardware, I've had a PS4 for maybe 3-4 years now, mm-hmm. and I've enjoyed plenty of games on it, but not a single one has ever left me feeling like this couldn't have existed on the PS3.
Mm.
Maybe in slightly scaled back form.
I saw, like, at the beginning of the generation, there was a lot of conversations around that. It was like, did we need this new console cycle? And certainly behind the scenes, a lot of devs didn't think so. A lot of devs thought the future of the industry was on PC, hence why no big games came out for the first couple of years. But that whole conversation, I thought that changed with The Witcher 3, just for the sheer size of it and the amount of stuff you can do in that game. Like, I know you can point to, like, The Elder Scrolls and stuff, but I remember looking at The Witcher 3 and being like, okay, we finally hit something that has a mark of quality across the board that, for me, didn't think you could do at all in the past gen, at least without drastically reducing graphics.
Speaking graphically.
Yeah, I think it's strange because some games obviously go all out on the graphical side, and something like Uncharted, like, you know, like, you don't need the graphics to enjoy that game. Like, it does, mm-hmm. The facial animation is obviously key to the emotional beats of the story, but that's not always the case. Like, I don't know, there's some stuff that you could reduce the graphics down and it would just work the same. I think The Witcher, its art direction, like, it has the best mesh of art direction and graphical clout kind of thing.
I think the most emotional game I've ever played is Firewatch.
Nice.
Yes.
And it's the opening text bit.
Yeah. Exactly. At no point in that game do you see the face of either the protagonist or his...
You do at the end.
...proposed love interest. Well, I
What's
guess...
What's the face draws you
I guess you do, but in the credit sequence...
Just to be a nerd.
That emotion plays out over a radio. It's entirely voice. You don't need high-fidelity graphics to deliver emotion.
Well, some of the best, and, like...
I'll give you another example. Books.
Yeah. But it's like, some of the best indie games or some of the best storytelling and character work is proving those points. Like, Thomas Was Alone is a brilliant platformer.
Again.
Proves you can do an entire character with a little square.
And didn't you feel
all
more,
in narration?
More emotional attachment to basic geometry?
Yeah. Anything in Anthem.
Or any of...
Yeah. If you guys haven't played Thomas Was Alone, like, it's literally, it's like the story of Thomas, who's a little pixel, and he meets up with different ones, and there's a big tall long one who thinks he's too tall and he sticks out and he's all nervous, and then there's a short little fat one who's worried about his weight and he can't jump very high, and you get told all this, it's all through the narration, but you do start to identify and empathize with these weird little, like, the pixels on screen, which sounds insane, but there's more heart there, there's more charm, there's more reason to replay it or play it in the first place than there is something as utterly soulless as Anthem. And so, like, that's my overall point.
Yeah. I, my only argument against this would be that when you get those great games like Thomas Was Alone or like Firewatch, especially the opening, we can have that, and we can also have the big, flashy, sort of cinematic, emotional stories to tell as well.
Yeah.
I think balance is key. Going back to, like, the film comparison, like, when New Hollywood kicked off and everyone was moving away from blockbusters and was going, like, director-orientated cinema, you got, like, a lot of those biting, authored sort of, like, movies, and that was great. But when that's all you have, then you crave the blockbusters again, you know what I mean? So I think you need, like, that balance.
I think what you're saying is entirely true, and I feel like with cinema as well, is that mainstream cinema isn't really for me now. I'm not a fan of comic book movies. I don't...
The hell?
Get out of bed.
it's no criticism. I'm just not, yeah. It just don't appeal to me. But it almost feels like they've entirely cornered the market of the cinema for a number of years now, and it's difficult for me to find movies that I want to see.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a lack of balance. And I think in gaming too, there's a lack of balance with AAA games. Like, that's all you can find in the shops to buy. Unless you go looking for these other experiences, you don't get them.
Because I think for me, it's rare. I think it's a balance of both sides. Like, I think that one of the most fascinating things about gaming is that it brings...
variety.
Yeah, it brings everything in.
It used to be the best thing about gaming, the amount of genres we used to have, which seem to have gradually vanished.
You know what? I was also thinking about the other day in the bath. I saw that Ed Boon...
he's moved.
Mortal Kombat. Obviously, the creative lead on Mortal Kombat was on about, like, he put out a Twitter post or something saying, which... fighting series would you like to see based on specific characters? And it was like superheroes, it was like Mortal Kombat, and there was like a bunch of other licensed people. And I just thought, when was the last time we got a fighting game? An original fighting game with original characters, like that was like AAA. Like, it doesn't happen anymore. Like, you get ones based on Injustice, based on superheroes.
Something like Rakuga Kids on the N64.
Wouldn't
sure, or Evil Zone, but just,
yeah, like stuff like that, like those genres that used to be so prolific and everywhere kind of been dwindled down a little
That's
bit.
The perfect way to wrap this up, because like all that experimentation, all that genre diversity, all of those, you know, the mechanical diversity, all that is in the indie scene. And you can go and find, like, you know, you can go find some Road Rash equivalent or whatever. You can go, like, you can dive into that. And there's so many genres in, I mean, it's such an umbrella term, the indie scene. But, like, you know, with something like the Unreal Engine going free, like, that elevated the overall bar of indie quality, I would say. And you can look to even something that's like a Hotline Miami adjacent thing, like Hong Kong Massacre. But the physics in that game are full-on Havoc physics. Like, you know, it's a shooter with good sensibility.
I mentioned it on the last pod I was mentioning, Hat in Time.
Yes, Hat in Time.
Plays, it's a little rough around the edges, I think I've said it at the time, but it plays very, very similarly to Super Mario Sunshine or a Banjo-Kazooie, which are AAA titles of their day and, like, the highest calibre. And this really, it does come very, very close to matching in terms of quality. And that was crowdfunded. You know, I think... what the indie game scene can do is, for people like me, for people like you, can say, do you remember the games you enjoyed as a child? Well, they still exist, and here they are. But for people who have been weaned on today's games, it opens their eyes to a whole new range of possibilities.
Yeah, I think it does do that for some... like, Hat in Time is clearly targeting the old-school, late-90s, third-person platformer 3D platformer market. But you have all these really innovative, like, progressive titles, like Gone Home, or... I mean, I don't know, like, there's just... there's a... like, Firewatch, there's a attempt to experiment with storytelling in the medium that is gone from the AAA space. Even though I would still point to, like, the odd thing, like God of War, like, being able to dissect video game violence in a really genius way. But, like, you see a more consistent example of experimentation in the indie scene. I think it's indie's where I go when I want to see the future of the medium. It's not AAA.
I think there's another really great point to make about why I hope it'd be the future. And that's down to the life of a developer.
Right.
Effectively, it's the pressures on the job, the stresses of the job, being able to control your hours in a more reasonable manner, expectations being a lot lower, security being a lot higher. Basically, to allow developers to enjoy developing games again.
True, yeah.
Small teams, tightly knit teams, knowing you're going to be there from the start to finish, you know, saving making circumstances. I think that's really important. It's something that obviously you can't expect consumers to think about when they're buying the game, thinking, well, what's my money paying for? What, is it worth it? But maybe it's something that we as a journalistic industry should be considering more and more.
I think so. I mean, one of the things that came out alongside Red Dead Redemption 2 was like all the work hours, and then, you know, that obviously got drilled down to the actual facts of it, but one of the things that was a fact was that Rockstar don't include your name on the credits if you didn't finish development, even if you've been there for years. So that's one of the things that can be highlighted. Different conversation, but like, yeah, that idea of the people behind the project, I think gaming has so much more to do in highlighting the people behind the work.
You might also notice that in the independent scene, the people behind the project, we know who they are. It's not supposed to be a point of egoism, but because the teams are small, we can know who they are. And it can be passion projects.
Yeah, and it's like they tend to go hand... like, you know, they're on Twitter, they're answering people's complaints. I mean, I remember when Eric Baroni first launched Stardew Valley, and like people would tweet him and be like, oh, there's a bug. If you do X, Y, Z, it does something else. And he'd be like, he'd literally go, give me a minute, he'd fix it, right, it's done. And then like, oh, there's a patch coming out soon. Like, he was just so on it. Like, you know, and you have that connection.
What it means is that the developer themselves is... the matter for a human being, you know, and they're considered, mm-hmm. rather not just, than just being an expendable nameless.
Yeah, not just being like a number.
Human resource.
Mm-hmm. I mean, as much as like something, again, I'm going to keep using Anthem because I think that is the tipping point. But Casey Hudson returned to BioWare to work on Anthem, and his name is hardly anywhere like associated with Anthem in as much as it was with Mass Effect 3 and Mass Effect 2, well, the Mass Effect trilogy. And it's like, it does point to this like irradiation or this eradication of like the people behind the work, and just he has a brand, he has the statistics, like all that kind of stuff.
Remember how cool and yet out of character it was for when Cory Barlog shipped God of War, and then he was looking at the reviews and like he started breaking down. Like that human element is completely absent from AAA games. Like you can barely even find like a director of a title. Like Hideo Kojima is like one of like the few examples of you know the guy, like the auteur or whatever behind the titles. But even that's not like a human element. He's still sort of like deified as this kind of like.
Well, that was why Corey's thing. Yeah, that's why Corey's thing was so great and it was so human. Like you still need those human connections. Yeah. I think that's part of one of the reasons why we're so passionate about indie stuff. And I think that way more people are. I think that stigma of them all being pixel platformers has gone away. But I just think it's worth reiterating that like there's so much to be found in the overall indie scene, which is, as a definition, just something that isn't the corporately designed industry scene, that is so just worthwhile and worth picking out. So I guess we should end on recommending one indie game each. I don't know what yours is. Well, I guess what yours is. Is it The Hat in Time again?
No, it isn't actually.
Go on, you can recommend one thing.
It depends on to what extent this classes as an indie game.
Mm.
And it's definitely not one that's under the radar, so it almost feels like a waste of recommendation.
It better not be Journey.
It's not Journey. But it's something similarly well-known. It's The Witness.
Oh, Witness is a beautiful, beautiful game.
Now, you talk about the people behind games, I'd say the most significant name in the game industry in the last 10 years probably is Jonathan Blow.
Mm-hmm.
His name is widely known, widely respected, and this is very much his game.
Yeah.
It's his money. It's quite a lot of his money, too much of his money.
Well, he almost funneled all of his money from Braid into this next thing.
I believe $8 million in the end. Possibly $6 million, but that's non-standard for an indie game.
True.
But it was definitely created with an indie mentality.
I was going to say the mentality. Yeah,
there was no like outside resources helping with it. But it's absolutely immaculate. Yeah. Every single detail in the design is down to the exact pixel. And it's that's not necessarily the mentality you get with AAA games, but it's definitely the case here. It's a masterpiece.
That game is entirely Jonathan Blow as well. Like if you watch interviews with him, like I think he's a Buddhist, but like he has like all these different mentalities, all these different philosophies on life that go into that game. I mean, The Witness, if you haven't played it, is third person exploration puzzle solving on an island, but it's all about cognition and information
if you were to summarize the game just in terms of mechanics, draw lines on panels on an island, there's absolutely no chance that game would ever be developed for
The thing that always annoys me with something like that is I think there's a way to make any idea appealing, and I just it's obviously not what they're chasing in terms of like that game. They're not going to do a big overblown trailer and you're one man on an island solving puzzles, but like, and it's not that you make it appealing in that way, but there's such a cool, relatable core like reason for that game exists that everyone should check out. What would yours be, Josh?
Well, I played these two games. You mentioned one already. So I played these two games in the same week about 3 years ago and haven't stopped thinking about them since. If you've seen a list by me, I'll have crammed these games into at least half of them. And that's Firewatch and Soma.
Oh,
Soma. Those are really great and like some of the best best told stories of the generation so far.
Firewatch's intro, like text-based intro, absolutely ruined me. If you guys haven't played Firewatch, just check that out, not knowing what you're going into. And then Soma is one of the most atmospheric horror games like of all time.
The ending of that left me and it's not perfect because it tries to appeal to a kind of mainstream crowd by crowbarring in some horror elements, but now there's a patch where you can just turn it off and enjoy the story. So just do that and enjoy.
I'm going to go back to it and see what that feels like. Go on.
I've just got another one to bring up.
This is what this podcast was initially going to be. I was like, no, we should have a structure, but go on.
It's been a decade since I played it now, but it's Machinarium.
Oh, man, okay.
Amanita Design, a Czech studio, developed by about six, seven people. It's a Flash-based point-and-click adventure. Unfortunately, it was Flash-based, which meant an awful lot of people pirated it. I bought it twice to make up for all those people. But,
I have six copies of Shovel Knight, carry on.
Yeah, it's basically just a point-and-click adventure, but it's only about 3 hours long. It's immaculate designed, beautiful artwork, absolutely gorgeous. No words, absolutely free of dialogue, and yet it tells its story perfectly from
That's lush. For my one, it's not going to be, because Firewatch might have been one of mine too. I absolutely love Gone Home. I love the whole, everyone calls it the walking simulator genre.
Yeah.
I'm a sucker for any of that stuff because it prioritizes storytelling and atmosphere. But for mine, it would be something that I just got the other day, which was Hand of Fate 2. I don't know if you guys have played the first Hand of Fate, but literally you're first person, you sit down, you're talking to a hooded guy and he's like, we should play a card game. And it's basically a Batman Arkham style combat system, but the way that you progress through the story is choose your own adventure. So the guy that you're playing against, all very mysterious. Guy plays some cards on the table, you turn them over one by one, and whatever the card is dictates the combat scenario or dictates which weapon you're going to pick up, and you kind of move through it that way. You might turn a card over and it'll be a merchant, and then you can get more food and whatever, but it's all very incremental, and you're making decisions the whole way. And so whenever you get through that like initial playing of the cards, you unlock more cards, which changes the deck that you're playing with, but the deck you're playing with is the story. So
it's like Pokemon Trading and Card Game.
Yeah, I don't know, but you know, it's just really cool. Like you'll get you might unlock you'll get a card at the end of a run, and it'll be something like Missing Boy, or like, you know, like the Ancient Sword. And so you put that in your deck and you play again, and you know that somewhere in this next shuffle is this next random kind of story element, but all the time you're, you know, making your character better and you're getting through it, and there's just such a great feeling to like playing an RPG in this like really unique, different way. It's the structure of it is unlike anything else, and it's really charming. The guy that you talk to just like berates you because he's like, oh, you messed up there, or it's just great. And you're overcoming him as much as you're overcoming like the cards themselves, and then the combat's not brilliant, but it's totally serviceable and it's nice. There's some finishes. Give me a combat system with more finishes is what I'm saying. I want some finishing moves.
Who cares about combat?
I care about the combat. But I think
I haven't got time, Josh. I'm so sorry, but I have played an indie game recently.
Yes.
It was Detention. Play that as well.
Is that a VR thing?
No.
Oh, it's you, isn't it? It's going to be a VR thing.
It's 2D. It's really good. Okay. I'm done now. That's it.
So that's hopefully enough for you to get on with. But you guys can let us know what you think down in the comments. If you would like a full-on half-hour thing where we just rattle through a bunch of indies, we're more than happy to do that. So let us know what you think down in the comments below.
Like 30 minutes, Exardimon, Yakuza Island Express. I'm willing to do that.
Yeah, and I'll happily break down the entire lore of Shovel Knight, even though no one wants that other than me and Yacht Club Games. But yes, let us know what you think down in the comments below, or find us on social media if you're listening on the audio platforms. This has been the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I've been your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Benjamin Richards.
Goodbye.
And Josh Brown.
Goodbye.
I'll catch you next time.
Bye-bye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.